Thanks, Tana. Let's say a prayer. Blessed Father, as we come to this text where it teaches us about forgiveness and patience, help us understand what that means and give us that spirit, a power of the Spirit deep in our hearts so we can do the same towards others. This I pray in Christ's name. Amen. Just a heads up, the Bradleys who usually sit back there, Sandra, they haven't been here last few weeks because her mom, Devona Weedrick, some of you know her, she broke her foot a little while ago, about a week ago, and so she's having a bit of a tough time. So I just thought I'd mention it, and you can maybe keep them in your prayers as she's trying to work through that. When you're an older person, you break a foot, it's not the easiest thing to deal with. Okay, how do we encourage people today to be honest and not to lie? How do we tend to do that? Well, it often goes like this. We say, don't lie or you'll be caught, or don't lie because society can't work well if you do. That's the humanistic approach. The religious approach often goes like this. Don't lie or God will punish you. In other words, what we do or tend to do is train people not to lie by playing on their insecurity and their fears. There's a problem with this, though. You can keep people from lying out of fear. But remember, fear also drives people to be dishonest and to lie. People are dishonest because they're afraid of, let's say, losing power, losing their jobs, looking bad in front of somebody, approval, or whatever. And therefore, such moral training, all it does is restrain the heart. It doesn't fundamentally change the heart. All we've done is jury-rig the roots of our dishonesty, fear, and insecurity. It may make people honest, at least for a while, but it's artificial and often temporary. So how can we make people into truly honest people? You need, as I've hinted at, a heart change. So you feel so absolutely loved that you're not afraid of anything. You need a heart transformed by God's grace through Jesus so that lying becomes unnecessary and even unnatural. But what are the marks of such a heart change? We're going to figure that out by looking at the Christian virtue today of patience, which is the central theme in today's passage read to us by Donna from Matthew 18. And in particular, we're going to look at three things. One, why do we need patience? Two, what is it? And then three, how do we get it? Simple. Why do we need it? What is it? How do we get it? Why do we need it? The key to understanding the theme of patience in this parable, I believe, is the magnitude of the debt. It says the king had some slaves with whom he wanted to settle their accounts. And when he began his reckoning, one owed him 10,000 talents. Now, that is meaningless to us, but it's important to know that the normal working man at the time, and there were men typically who worked, only made 1 to 1.5 talents in a year. So clearly this servant was not the king's cook. Likely he was a steward who ruled over regions, provinces, even countries on the king's behalf. And he incurred so much debt because he either grossly mismanaged the king's funds or he was very, very corrupt. Now, the impact on the king would have been significant. See, back then, they were not public funds. It's not something a government would print out like they do today. Every single coin, it tended to be coins, belonged directly to whomever was the king or the emperor or ruler of the day. That's why when Jesus in one passage pulled out of his pocket a coin with Caesar's picture on it, and he said to the people, "Whose is this?" The people said, "Caesar's." And when they said that, they were literally right. It belonged physically to Caesar. So for the king, the loss of this much money was a threat to his very kingdom. And yet, when the slave says to the king, "Be patient," the king forgives him. Now, what does this word patient mean? It's important to figure it out because the English word patience doesn't really get across the original Greek meaning. The Greek word makrothumeia means to be long-temperate. Maybe you could say long-suffering, as opposed to short-tempered. Thumeia means it refers to a boiling feeling. So to illustrate Think of mercury. Mercury at room temperature will still melt and kind of lose its shape. But all other metals, when they have to be heated up, and when they're heated up, they will run all over the place. Therefore, macrothumeia, or long temperate, means this. Spiritual patience is the inner power to bear injuries, offenses, or whatever, without a meltdown and running all over. So that when things happen to you, they don't destroy you inside. They don't destroy your inner poise, your inner joy, your inner sense of self. You're not affected and controlled inwardly by what is done to you outwardly. Now, why is this so important? Which it is. The King James Version of Luke 21:16 says, "In patience possesses ye your souls." Typically, when you suffer at the hands of somebody else, you feel like a victim, typically. And often because you have no choice in the matter. You have no choice that somebody did something to you, right? You didn't choose to be robbed. You didn't choose to be called names or whatever. But to be long-suffering or temperate is a deliberate, active, bold choice you can make. So on the one hand, it requires that you accept your suffering. On the other hand, you resist it, not letting it do things to you you don't want it to do, especially inside. However, this word is more specific in this context because it's referring to a specific aspect of long-suffering. Because the word thumeia means boiling passion, but it often refers to anger. And that's the context in which Jesus is using this word. So the kind of patience we're looking at here is the inner power to bear injuries, abuse, or snubbing from other people without melting down inside into resentment and anger. So let me tell you why we need this so much. Many of you, or maybe many of you, are thinking right now, well, I'm not an angry person. I'm not angry with anybody right now. I don't have problems forgiving people. Mike, maybe I'll refer some friends I know who do to listen to your sermon online. Thanks very much, but that might be good for them. I don't really need it. Well, I'd say don't be so sure. Don't be so sure. Hebrews 12:15 says, "Take care unless any harbor a root of bitterness, which springing up defiles many." Why is anger called a root? Well, there are two reasons. First, we may be willing to admit to others and ourselves our anxiety, even that we have problems with lust, maybe that we have depression issues. But rarely will we admit to other people our anger, and often we'll minimize it. Therefore, second, anger works in a very subterranean way in your life. It's deep down in you. It's kind of like, you know, you try to get rid of weeds. If you pluck it up, the roots down there, and it'll keep working away and pop back up, right? And it's working in you so you don't even know how it's affecting you. How does it affect you? Well, we minimize it, as I suggested, by saying, yes, I've been deeply disappointed with my parents, let's say, sometimes very angry with them, but that hasn't changed how I deal with maybe figures of authority, the opposite sex, attitude towards the church. Really? Unless there is a truly true transformation of one's heart, your heart, so you can forgive people, you'll always minimize how mad you are, how much someone has hurt you, and how cynical, hard-hearted, filled with prejudice and self-pity you truly are. Look at the way this parable, by the way, ends. The king says, "Since you are not grateful what I've done, since you have not forgiven your fellow servant, into prison you go to be tortured." Now that's pretty harsh. That's pretty hard. He's a pretty harsh guy. Now why does Jesus include this bit in the parable? It can be interpreted in a quite easily the wrong negative way. I think this is what it's saying. If you do not forgive and can't control your anger when somebody mistreats you so it doesn't affect you deep down in your heart, your life is going to be a torment in misery. Okay? You're the one that's going to get hurt. You're the one internal that's going to be boiling over and a mess. And you're going, it's going to be like feeling, it's going to feel like you're in prison. You're not going to be free of it. And I'm sure you all have experienced this. I know I have. And that's why patience is so important. Now, what is it? There are three things you need to do when you're wronged. And this is hard to hear, but bear with me. And I'm not just talking, by the way, about the big things that happen to you, but primarily about the everyday little snubs that occur to you, because those little roots of anger will also impact you deep down. Notice what the king does to the first slave. It says he took, one, took pity on him, two, canceled the debt, and three, let him go. First, let's look at how he canceled the debt. The first step towards a forgiving spirit, the development of a forgiving spirit, is do not take revenge. Do not make the other person pay the emotional debt of pain you're experiencing, but instead pay it down yourself. Now, just by a sidebar here, I'm not saying that if someone has wronged you legally, you should not take legal redress. This is not what I'm talking about. But what I mean is this. It's important to know and understand that whenever somebody wrongs you, recognize that it always, always creates an emotional debt of pain inside you that you feel, always, when someone wrongs you, okay? And unless it's paid down, it will not go away. So first accept the fact, you know, sometimes we feel guilty that we have the feeling. No, that's normal to have the feeling. The question, though, is who will pay down the debt? Now, most of us make, or at least want to make, the other person pay it down. And, you know, direct ways of doing it, something will insult them, will be harsh, will be cold to them. Indirect ways, might slander them, gossip about them. That's a nice occupation in the life of the church sometime. Ruin the reputation, whatever. Why do you want to hurt the other person? Why? Let's face it, because it makes you feel better. Okay? It makes you feel better. I didn't get into details with the kids, but I remember one kid was kind of beating up on my sister, and then I went and beat him up. And I felt better, to be honest. I'd be dishonest that I didn't, but I did feel better at the time. And the more you hurt, the better you feel, because it relieves the debt you feel. But there's, of course, a problem with it. When you make the other person pay the debt, his wrongdoings passes into you. It melts you, changes, and controls you. Here's a true story of a pastor who offered a parent, a father, to bring his children to his church. The children had come to vacation Bible school in the summer, really enjoyed it. They weren't going to church, but so the pastor went up, asked the dad. But when the pastor asked the dad if he could take them, the dad said, never. My dad shoved church down my throat, and so my kids are never going to church. There's no way he was going to let his father get his way with his grandchildren as he did with him. What's happening here? What basically happening is the dad is still controlled by the father. He thinks he's beaten his father, but in reality, his father has beaten him. He's controlled him. And on top of that, he's held his kids back. For the wrong reasons, if there's ever a good one, but that's definitely a wrong one. When we make the other person pay the debt, we become like the person who hurts us. Their evil passes into us and makes us bitter, makes us cynical, distorts how we see things, and we're often full of self-pity. Or the other thing is, you can pay it down yourself. It says that the king canceled the debt. But let's be clear, it didn't just go off into the air. He absorbed it. You have to pay down the debt if you're going to have a forgiving heart. How does that work? Well, let me give you some directions here. Every time you rehash, I know I do this often, every time you rehash what you want to do to the person who has offended you, don't. Every time you want to rub their noses in it, don't. Every time you want to be cold to them, be warm to them. Every time you have a chance to put them down in the mind of someone else, don't. And here's the issue, too, unfortunately. Each time you do this, it will hurt. It does hurt. Why does it hurt? And often, sometimes, it hurts very much. Why? Because there's no doubt that when you make the evil doer pay the debt, it helps you feel better. But again, as I said before, you're also being warped by the same evil in your heart. But if you instead pay the debt slowly, the anger will leave you. The control of your heart will leave you. Now, depending on the size of the wrong, it may take hours, days, weeks, sometimes years. But when you pay down the debt, the other person's evil will not eventually melt you, will not reshape it into its own image and possess your soul. So first, don't take revenge and pay down the debt yourself. Second, it says the king felt pity. This is an unfortunate, wimpy kind of English translation for the Greek, which really means to be moved with deep compassion for someone else's misery. And this is very important. Whenever someone else wrongs you, what does your heart immediately want to do? It often wants to immediately stress the difference between yourself and the other person. So if you want to have a forgiving spirit, a soul that's not possessed and bear injuries to the meltdown, you have to make a conscious decision to stress the commonalities between you and that person. Okay? I'll say it again. You need to make the conscious decision to stress the commonalities between you and that person, not the differences. What do I mean by that? Whenever someone wrongs you, what we tend to do is you tend to make a caricature of them by reducing the person to what he's done to you. You know, in the opinion sections of newspapers, you notice pictures, you've got maybe a picture of Donald Trump and they'll exaggerate the size of his head or something. Or you may exaggerate the size of someone's nose. That's what they're trying to get across. They're caricaturing the person. So when, let's say, somebody lies to you, you caricature the person and call the person a liar. Of course, they're a lot more than a liar, but that's what you do. You call the person, that person's a liar. And you know you're doing this because if you think about yourself, and let's say you're caught lying, you'll say, well, that's a little more complex. It's different. There are mitigating circumstances. In other words, you see yourself in 3D, but you see the other person one-dimensionally. And here is why. Deep down in every human soul, there is this deep desire to justify oneself because we're afraid we're not worthy. We're afraid we're not acceptable. So we go on defense. And that deep fear, unfortunately, leads to justifying yourself is beside all kinds of negative things that happen that you can do. It's behind racism, workaholism, gossiping, all kinds of things. That's why you say whenever someone wrongs you, I would never do that. Ever said that? I would never do that. That way you can feel better. You can feel nobler. You can feel superior. But if you don't want to be melted down by your transgressor, you need to look at the commonalities you share with that person. You need to say, okay, that person is weak, but so am I. That person does stupid things. Maybe I don't do the same stupid things, but I still do stupid things. That's what you need to be able to say. And only that way can you begin at least to be free of your anger and have a forgiving spirit. So to have a forgiving spirit, first, pay down the debt yourself. Don't make the other pay. Second, find commonalities, not differences, between you and that person who hurts you. And then you're free to do the third thing. It says in the text, the king let him go. Now, why would he let him go? Does this guy care about justice and truth? What about justice and truth in all this? Well, for the answer, we need to go look at what the king's forgiven slave does to the second slave. He meets the second slave who owes him 100 denarii. Not near as much as he owed the king, but still a sufficient amount. But instead of having pity on the man, he does. He grabs the man by the neck and shouts at him and says, pay what you owe me. He's got no pity for the man and then throws him into prison.
clearly this first slave is vicious. He's a vile, vicious, oppressive man who is used to abusing people. What's the point? Maybe you've had people say this to you, but I've had people say to me, I don't want to forgive. I want justice. Maybe you've thought that. I know I've thought that. I want to say clearly, never pit those two things together. If you don't first forgive, you'll never get justice. If you think you can go and confront someone with the wrong they've done to you without first forgiving them, you won't get justice. Instead, you're going to hurt them and then just perpetuate injustice. Things will just spiral into a back and forth paybacks. And on top of that, you won't hopefully win them back to a gospel way of living. Therefore, from the gospel perspective, vengeance is actually quite selfish. It's quite selfish. But so, by the way, in case you're thinking this, is resignation. You know, when you're thinking, oh, don't worry about it, just forget it, let sleeping dogs lie. That's not good either, because you still are not dealing with the injustice and not giving an opportunity for the other person to actually change. A forgiving spirit doesn't like conflict. It's okay to not like conflict, but it's not okay to avoid it. It doesn't do vengeance, but it doesn't avoid confrontation. Okay? That's not all. So these are the three marks of forgiving spirit. So how do you do this? All you have to do now is go out there and do it. Okay? I end the sermon. You just go out there, do it, and good luck. Okay? Does that sound like a good answer? No problem, right? You can just go out there and do it? Not likely, right? Well, here's how are we ever going to be able to do this? Well, it's important to keep in mind that in telling this story about this king, Jesus is pointing to someone beyond him. When Jesus was first looking down on us, he knew that we would cost him everything. And that a debt somehow had to be paid. The last thing Jesus said just before he died was, "It is finished." But do you know that the original Greek means something else? It means it is paid. Why? See, our turning away from God, our rejection of Jesus as the true King of the universe, our selfishness, our self-centeredness, has caused this enormous debt with God. And someone has to pay it if there's going to be justice in the world. Now, I've heard some people say, why did Jesus have to die on the cross? Why didn't he just forgive us? Because that would not take care of the debt we owe. And therefore, if it's not taken care of, we'll never be freed of our self-centered ways. We'll always be controlled by that selfishness, that self-pity, that whatever. We'll always be controlled. The debt has to be paid somehow so we can be free of it. Someone has to pay it. And fortunately, it was not us. It was, of course, Jesus on the cross. See, in bearing your debt, bearing my debt, the world's debt, a cosmic debt, what he's done is now opened a path for you and me to have a forgiving spirit. And thus, having a forgiving spirit, we now can be free of our anger, of our self-pity, of our self-righteousness, of our souls being possessed, okay, by these things. So simply the degree to which you realize what Jesus has done for you, and the degree to which you seek his forgiveness, will you then have a forgiving spirit. And thus be free of someone else's anger towards you, and letting that anger along with the self-pity possess your heart. Amen.